fugitives. He, a thinker in the in that movement, and he has been at the center of almost all its major initiatives. He most recently wrote Deglobalization, Ideas for a New World Economy, which is a kind of a distillation of his thinking on the question of the of how to respond to today's imperialism, what it looks like and how to respond. I just mentioned just before that he produced a book called The Future and the Balance, Essays on Globalization and Resistance, two crucial books for the new movement. He's just recently, I see, I haven't read it yet, but wrote an article that's just come out, Pax Romana versus Pax Americana, Contrasting Strategies of Imperial Management. I should say that Walden was in Baghdad just before the bombing on a peace mission. So without further ado, Walden.
Thank you. Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here again and to be speaking with Tariq Ali and Giovanni Arrighi and Robert Brenner, people that I very much hold in high esteem and are in many ways models for my politics and for much of the intellectual work that I've done. So as you can see, I'm probably the youngest of the lot here. So
don't brag.
I just want to start with sort of four impressions that sort of might capture the flavor of the times. In last year, in February of March of 2002, a number of us went on what we call the peace mission to the island of Basilan in Mindanao, where the U.S. sent special forces to allegedly to help the Philippine army track down the Abu Sayyaf, this group that has a propensity for kidnapping Americans for reasons both religious and financial. but in any event, I think in our interaction with the U.S. Special Forces people there and the U.S. military people, it was fairly clear who were calling the shots in a military operation, despite the fact that the Americans were not supposed to engage in combat. And this sort of typifies what is happening in the Philippines and in Southeast Asia at this point. U.S. troops have been pouring in to basically engage in police functions, which should really be, theoretically, the province of a national government. We used to have U.S. bases in the Philippines in 1992, but they were kicked out. But now we have something worse, which is the whole Philippines has become a U.S. base because of constant military exercises in which more and more Americans are beginning to shed off the fact that they're just there in a support role. That's the first image that I would like to bring, and because I think that captures sort of the reality of what's going to happen more and more in Southeast Asia. The second image that I would like to bring up is when we were in Baghdad a few days before the American bombing, the two things were very, very stark. One was that Baghdad was, for all intents and purposes, an open city. There were no defenses at all, or no attempts to even erect defenses. That was the first thing. The second thing that came out is that as you talk to people, and this we tried to meet as many people as possible, and we really had no minders except translators and people who were driving us around, serving as drivers, was a very strong, as Tariq had said, feeling against the United States, and that people hesitated to say anything about Saddam Hussein, but there was always one thing that came out clear and very strongly in a spontaneous way, that that if the United States came in, they would not last very long. One student of a Shakespeare class in English that we barged into and asked the teacher if we could talk to people. One student quite spontaneously said, and they were reading Romeo and Juliet, what did they think of George Bush's idea of liberating them? And they said, well, George Bush is like Tybalt, a man who's clumsy and ill-intentioned. And another student said that, we've been invaded for thousands of years, and every time a new invader has come on the horizon, they've always told us that they want to liberate us. The third image that I would just like to raise, because I think this ties in with many of the things that Tariq has said, is that as we were exiting the border between Iraq and Syria, because at that point, if you wanted to hightail it out of Baghdad, there were no more flights, and you just had to take this horribly expensive, they were going up by 100% every 6 hours, GMC trucks. Was as we were going out, we had a whole bunch of people coming in, and volunteers, and we had long talks with them from Tunisia, from Algeria, from Morocco, all over, extremely highly motivated and raring to meet the United States in combat, and basically feeling that that this was an opportunity to be able to take on the United States. We read about Islamic volunteers, and they made it a point, because I asked if they were Arab volunteers, and they said, no, not Arab volunteers, we're Islamic volunteers. So I think that's a fairly important point to note. Finally, an image that we had talking to a number of people in connected with diplomatic functions in Syria, asking them about what they thought would happen in Iraq, and basically them saying that we're extremely worried about what's going to happen because, and this was before the war, because if the Americans come into Iraq, then we might be next. So there is a very great realization, therefore, that this thing will probably not end in Iraq. And so I was not really surprised when suddenly on television, on I think the second week of the invasion, suddenly Rumsfeld comes up on television and says that, and warned Iraq, Syria, about supporting and hiding and taking in weapons of mass destruction from Iraq. So I just wanted to start with those images because I think they pretty much capture this sort of interactions that are now occurring between the United States and the South. What I would just like to do very quickly here is to go through what I would consider to be some of the features of the current period. A great deal of this really intersects with what Tariq says, and possibly with what Giovanni says. First of all, I think that the recent events, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, I would place, within as a moment within the ongoing crisis of global capitalism. I would see as part of the ongoing crisis of this phase of globalization. And say that I think the era of globalization was something real. It wasn't just some, it wasn't just a phase that we could just call natural capitalist expansion. I think what we did see under globalization was the accelerated integration of capital production and markets dictated by transnational corporate profitability. Second was the increased reliance for the maintenance of its hegemony by the United States on the multilateral institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, and the IMF. Third, it was in fact accompanied by an ideology of neoliberalism, privatization, deregulation, and liberalization that was that had its hard and soft versions, hard in Reaganism and soft in the sort of Blairite compassionate capitalism. And that this phase really lasted from 1980 up till today. I think there were three moments to this crisis prior to the recent developments in Iraq. The first was, before saying that, I think that the apogee or the height of this, the period of globalization was, I would say, was the founding of the World Trade Organization in 1995. This was, the WTO was seen as the gem of global economic governance. This was supposed to be something that in the establishment propaganda was an organization that would set a multilateral set rules that would govern rich and poor, big and small countries. I think this sort of image about what the WTO represented was articulated by Soros when he said, this is the most important organization in the world because it's the only organization to which the United States would subordinate its sovereignty, unquote. I think in terms of the sense of triumphalism, probably Singapore ministerial in 1996 sort of captured this when the three big institutions of global economic governance, the IMF, WTO, and World Bank, came out with a common statement saying that the task of the future was coherence among the three of us, trade, finance, aid, so that we could articulate a framework on which global prosperity would move from now on. So I would say that 1995 was the height of this process. 5 years later, the globalist project and its neoliberal ideology was in very serious trouble. And I would cite the three moments that characterized this. 1997, the Asian financial crisis. And I think that what the Asian financial crisis in fact showed was that this process of liberalization of capital was an extremely unstable process that would provoke crisis after crisis. And indeed, the Asian financial crisis was just one, maybe the most important up till then, of a series of crises that had been wrecking the global capitalist system since the early 1980s. And one of the elements of the crisis was, of course, that I think is quite important, is that some of the fiercest, some of the defenders of the neoliberal globalist system, like Bhagwati, like Soros, like Jeffrey Sachs, in fact began to desert the intellectual legitimation of that system. And when intellectuals, especially its most accomplished defenders, begin to desert a system that is extremely serious in terms of its impact. The Asian financial crisis, therefore, was not just a real crisis, but it, in fact, accentuated a crisis of legitimacy of the system, which led to a reexamination of the role of the IMF and the World Bank in the rest of the world, in Latin America and in Africa and in South Asia, that led to the conclusion that the processes of structural adjustment and the theory of structural adjustment, the strategy of structural adjustment, was a massive failure throughout the Third World. Very few successes. So the next moment of this was the 1999, the collapse of the WTO ministerial. And I think it wasn't just the collapse of a ministerial in one city, But the way that Seattle really brought together macro and micro processes that were at work through the whole world at that point in time. Seattle basically was a nightmare from their side, a magic from our side, that was composed of three elements. And I think these three elements are very important. One was the revolt of the developing countries at the Seattle Convention Center. And that revolt really was motivated by the fact that they could no longer keep on pushing this sort of adjustment and trade strategies on their peoples. I mean, this was basically a revolt, refusal to sign a new declaration that came out of the increasing mass pressures on this government. The second thing is the mass mobilization in Seattle. Again, I think that the 50,000 people in Seattle came from all over the world, and they were representative of the emergence of this global mass movement against globalization. Very diverse, and 50,000 people came there, and it was the interaction between those people and the people at the Seattle Convention Center that was extremely important. The third thing that I think we should not emphasize, especially in the current period, is that part of the reason, very important, that the ministerial collapse was divisions between the EU and the United States on agriculture and a whole lot of areas. And I think these divisions were very real divisions, divisions brought about by competing efforts at economic hegemony. This third moment was the collapse of the U.S. stock market and the end of the Clinton boom, which occurred in 2000 and 2001. And as people like Robert Brenner, of course, has done this, extremely cogently, that the sort of financial collapse was really just the tip of the iceberg of a crisis of overproduction, overaccumulation, and that the frenzied speculative activity of the last years of the Clinton period really was speculative activity that was driven by the lack of profitability in the real economy. And since you have a situation whereby the share values could not divert too much, too fast from the real movements in the real economy, this brought about, or this was one of the factors that brought about that collapse. What of course has become clear since then is that this is not any ordinary recession. This is a much, much more serious inauguration of a period of stagnation, call it the trough or the downside of the quantitative wave or what. Nevertheless, it does seem like if one reads Business Week from week to week, which I do at this point, the business news page has not changed. The recovery is just around the corner, but these indicators are not yet there. So it's like I can write the business news page of the Business Week at this point in time. Now, the reason I mention this is that I think that this crisis of the globalist project and neoliberalism, the crisis of overproduction or overaccumulation, provides the context for understanding the economic thrust, unilateral thrust of the Bush administration. I think that I think globalization, and I think what we can say here is that the different national capitalist elites, to use that word, and the United States elite in particular, has both a contradictory sort of drive. On the one hand, it has a common interest with the other global capitalist elites in expanding the global capitalist economy, a common dependence, and yet has this common dependence coexists with competition. The period of globalization was a period in which, for instance, during the Clinton period, the sort of expansion of the global economy, globalist project, took precedence over the competitive elements of the relationship. And I think Bob Brenner, in fact, has a very good case of this sort of priority that the Clinton administration assigned to the getting Japan and Germany out of recession by adopting a strong dollar policy, although in the short term this would in fact result in difficulties for the U.S. economy, but with the realization that unless you have these other center economies move and expand, that indeed the U.S. economy was in the long term in trouble. I think the Bush administration's political economy reflects what I would say, for lack of a better term at this point, the political economy of the more nationalist faction of the U.S. ruling class. And I would just like to briefly go through some of the elements of the approach of this of this group. One is, I think there is a wariness about globalization that is driven purely by market forces, although there is a great deal of paying obeisance to free markets in the ideology. In fact, there is a wariness of something that is not controlled by the U.S. state because of the way that this would diffuse U.S. economic power. The second thing that I would just like to mention with respect to this is that you have a more sort of instrumental view of multilateral institutions. Of course, the U.S. has always had an instrumental view of multilateral institutions. Nevertheless, the U.S. in the past also felt that it was important to give the Europeans and the Japanese their say in these multilateral institutions and sometimes to win some battles. But now I think even that sort of primus inter pares sort of view is out. It's now always primus in the IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO. The third is I think this nationalist faction of the ruling class is very much tied to the military-industrial complex that won the Cold War, has become quite the dominant faction, and that basically this is not, these are intellectuals, this is a national security establishment, these are all the firms that are tied into, you know, a very strategic sector of the U.S. economy. For these people, strategic power is the ultimate modality of power. Economic power is important principally as a means to augment strategic power, and economic power must be subordinated to strategic objectives. Many of these people never took courses in economics, in fact. Indeed, the example of China is a very interesting example between the globalists and the hegemonists, because in the case of the globalists and Wall Street, of course, and much of U.S. capital, China has been the mecca for capital. It is the area that for investment that would counter decreasing profitability in the U.S. economy. It's an area or an economy that will produce all the sort of goods that are no longer being produced by the United States. Very key. On the other hand, the nationalists have always railed against this growing economic dependence on China because of their sense that building up China now is really building up a strategic enemy. It is, of course, there is no easy exit from this sort of contradiction. Nevertheless, I think China has a sense that the balance has definitely tilted towards the hegemonists and that this will indeed result in a more sort of punitive economics when it comes to China. Let me just briefly say that what do we expect in terms of the economic policies of the coming period? First is the priority that is attached to the control of oil. This isn't only to assure cheap oil for the United States, but also of control of Europe and ultimately control of oil for China. Extremely strategic from this point of view. The second is this is going to be a highly protectionist in trade and investment. We have already seen the way that you know, the U.S., the Bush administration has maintained and kept up its tariffs on steel. In the agreement on agriculture, there is no give in terms of the United States in terms of its farm subsidies. The United States, in terms of trade-related intellectual property rights and public health, the United States is the only bloc now because the pharmaceutical industry doesn't want its profits eroded into subordinating trips to public health purposes. More recently, the sort of extremely nationalistic handing out of contracts in Iran, in Iraq. In fact, for these people, that two most congenial agreements in the WTO is the Agreement on Agriculture and the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights, because these are really two agreements that promote monopoly. The third thing that I think we should expect is a more aggressive manipulation of the dollar to stick the costs of the economic crisis on the rivals of the United States and the South while delivering benefits from it. And fourth is, again, the more aggressive manipulation of the multilateral agencies to push the interests of the United States. I really much doubt very much whether, unlike in 2001, when they were able to get together before the Doha meeting of the WTO to come together to push for a new trade round, that they will be able to come together to push for a new trade round, reconcile some of their differences before the Cancun summit that is going to be taking place in September. So
you doubt if they will.
I doubt if they will. So let me just say that the second phase of globalization, which if we say that the first phase was the 19th century up till 1914, and the second phase is from 1980 to 2000, that this phase is over and giving way to an era of inter-imperialist competition, to say a word that has already been used by Peric as well as by Giovanni. However, I think I would just like to say draw out some of the things that Tariq said, that it is also going to give rise to an era of overextension. Overextension is a mismatch between the goals and the resources of the United States. And I think one thing that really worsens overextension is the way that that the United States is acting purely militarily, whereas in the past, the ideological and the political resources were very important. That those are secondary and tertiary when it comes to the United States, and I think this is going to be a real problem, because without consent, without legitimacy, an empire is really overdrawn and overextended. This is, I think, when they talk about imposing democracy in the Arab world, I think they say it tongue in cheek. They really are talking about using the mechanisms of liberal pluralistic democracy in order to disaggregate and to destroy Arab unity. And it's almost, they're very transparent even when they say this. So even this sort of vision of extending liberal democracy that used to accompany the old US imperial vision is now gone. So in addition to the indicators in the Middle East that Tariq had mentioned, I think we need to also look at some of the elements of overextension. For instance, the rise to power in Latin America of anti-U.S. regimes in Venezuela, in Brazil, and in Ecuador, and I think that this will become an even greater problem with the United States, whether or not the United States will be able to focus on Latin America after this adventure in the Middle East. I really doubt if that will happen. You now have a real big anti-American movement in South Korea, which must not really be underestimated. It just came into being in the last 2 years, but they're very worried about South Korea at this point in time, and I think Tariq will also mention something regarding that. And let me just end by... And of course, Southeast Asia, we do have popular Islamic movements that are at work there that are, in fact, challenging the United States. Let me just end by saying here that, and talk a bit just about the resistance. I think one of the most important byproducts of the recent period has been this globalization of the peace movement. This is definitely something new. But beyond the globalization of the peace movement, you really had the coming together and the unification of the peace movement and the anti-corporate globalization movement. Very powerful force at this point in time. The second thing that I think is also very important and must not be underestimated, again, is all across the Asian landmass, the rise of Islamic movements of various stripes and various kinds. I think that the third is the reemergence of the old balance of power, 1914-type politics. And I think we need to talk here not only about France and Germany, but also about Russia and China, although China will be very sophisticated in playing this game. Nevertheless, this is now a reality. And I think that the dynamics of the next period will be to what extent these three sort of developments, the anti-globalization movement, the anti-US, the Islamic movements, and the China, France, Germany, Russia, the anti-US sort of state opposition, will be able to articulate with one another. Of course, there's going to be a great deal of contradictions among these various forces, but there will also be a great deal of unities, and I think a great deal of what happens in the future is how, especially the coming from the anti-corporate globalization movement and the global peace movement, is how this movement is going to be able to relate to these other forces to be able to take advantage of this overextended U.S. Power. So, just two things. What are we trying to do about this, or some of the people in the movement? In about 2 weeks, we have a global peace movement meeting in Jakarta to ask where do we bring the global peace movement after Iraq? And it is not coincidental that it's being held in Jakarta, because Jakarta had the biggest, Indonesia in Asia, the biggest anti-US mobilizations, and they were mainly led by the Islamic movements. And what is going to be very interesting is how do we bring together the Islamic movements and the secular peace movements around a common agenda, at least in this case. The second thing, of course, is Cancun in September 10 to 15. You know, here is going to be a very problematic conference for global capital. If they do not pull off Cancun, then they're in real trouble. I think that at this point, the global peace and anti-corporate globalization movement is really mobilizing to become a factor in Cancun to try to disaggregate, you know, further the existing disunities within the global capitalist elite to make sure that Cancun does not become another Doha, but in fact, Cancun becomes another Seattle. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, so it's about 10:02. Can we take a break? And please come back just a little bit after 4. Coffee is across the hall. We'll reconvene for questions, discussion.
Right. I have a couple of questions for you.
That thing about Korea,
I should have for you.
It's amazing.
But so what did you say?